Before we get started, I forgot to do this when we began. My name is Robert Hawthorne. To my right is Gilbert Roman, Judge Gilbert Roman.
Not Roman.
Not Roman, Roman. And to my left is Judge David Furman. And counsel, we are ready to proceed on People versus Kano when you are.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. Gregory Lansky, bar registration number 38515 for Raymond Kano. My client, Raymond Kano, is currently serving a life without parole sentence for a conviction of first-degree murder. This appeal concerns the denial of his post-conviction claims, specifically his 35C claims. For the purposes of today's argument, I do want to focus on the issue which was the subject of the evidentiary hearing on the Sixth Amendment claim regarding the conflict of interest. And specifically, it's undisputed that there was a conflict here. And the conflict was that while Mr. Kano's attorneys from the Brighton Public Defender's Office was representing him on his first-degree murder matter, at the same time during trial, another attorney was representing a material and exculpatory witness who was endorsed both by the prosecution and by the defense in this case. There is no dispute that there was a concurrent and contemporaneous representation during Mr. Kano's trial. And I submit to this court, under the rules of professional conduct as existed during Mr. Kano's trial back in 1996, the case law as back in 1996, the Ultra Defense Statute 21-2-103, and under the Public Defender's own conflict policy, this was considered a conflict. And to understand why this was a conflict, you really have to understand, you know, the circumstances of this case and how it was presented to the jury. And essentially what happened, the victim here in this case was a gang member. The victim wanted out of the gang. This victim was threatened by other gang members saying that, well, if you want out of the gang, there's really only one way out of the gang, and they pretty much threatened him with his life. Really, notwithstanding that, the victim breaks off all contact with this gang. Months passed, and all of a sudden, these gang members invite him to this party, this New Year's Eve party, which was meant for gang members. He hadn't spoken to these other gang members for a long time, and now they're trying to entice him to come to this party. He says, okay, I'm going to come to this party. He goes to the party. Everybody's acting very strangely toward him and his girlfriend. They lead him down to the basement. A lot of gang members are there at that time. They take a photograph. They all very quickly leave the basement. He's by himself with two other people. He walks up the stairs, and he gets stabbed. And unfortunately, he dies. The reason why Sergio Aguilar is so important on this case is because Mr. Aguilar was on the staircase when this happened, when this stabbing happened. His initial report to the police was that, the victim fell onto me on the stairs, and I don't know who the perpetrator was, and I was in the kitchen, I was with the victim at that time. And what happened during evidentiary hearing, Mr. Kano's attorneys agreed that, Mr. Aguilar could have provided exculpatory and beneficial information. And the reason why he could provide such information was because of he knew Mr. Kano before this trial, and he said he didn't know who the perpetrator was initially. He didn't see Mr. Kano in the kitchen as alleged by other witnesses. He didn't point out that Mr. Kano in the lineup procedure. The girlfriend who was with the victim on the staircase, when asked to describe what did this perpetrator look like, she pointed to Sergio Aguilar. In addition, Sergio Aguilar, in his car, possessed a book, a gang book. And his gang book had essentially a name of a subsect gang name. It had a number of different names, gang names in it. And this was very important for the defense because their whole theory of this case was that this was a gang setup, this was a gang hit. And they used Mr. Kano as a fall guy. And that gang book, which was located in Sergio Aguilar's car, had the names of gang people who belonged to the subset gang which included names of the people who initially threatened the victim in this case, who initially called the victim to entice them to come to this party. And lastly, they were the ones who testified against Mr. Kino. So this gang book was clearly, physical and tangible evidence, which was crucial and important to the defense's theory of the case that this was a gang set up and these guys had relationships.
All right, go ahead, Mr.
Lansky, the trial court applied Strickland to this hearing, right? And not a Kyler v. Sullivan analysis.
It seems unclear what the court did. It seems they did a hybrid of both. But clearly the Strickland analysis does not apply in this situation.
Sides agree with. But if whatever the judge did with prejudice under Strickland, what do we do with an adversely affected counsel's performance query, given the findings of the judge after the hearing?
Okay, well, with regards to the findings of the judge, one thing I want to comment on is that the attendant circumstances, the fact that both of Mr. Kino's counsel were aware that 8 days before opening statements that he was in custody at Adams County District Attorney's in custody in jail, the Adams County Jail. He was being charged in Adams County for attempted first-degree murder. They had the arrest warrant, they had the arrest papers, discovery and other paperwork and the charge information in their file. So they had knowledge that in fact another attorney would be representing Sergio Aguilar on his case because they testified at the evidentiary hearing based upon their experience and the custom in the office that when someone's arrested on such a case, that attorney will appear within the week. That was
But I want to go back to the Kyler adverse effect query. Okay. And first off, is that a question of fact?
No, it's a question of law, and this court has the opportunity to do a de novo review of that, and that's the standard.
What happened on remand after Kyler came out?
Judge, I don't say no. After remand, this court was not, this case
to the Federal Circuit on Kyler. Was it remanded for an evidentiary hearing?
I'm not sure about that, but I think what the court is asking about, what is the standard? How do you prove adverse effect? And I think it's pretty clear. I mean, the Colorado Supreme Court spoke about this issue in Castro, and it recently was, spoken to again by, I think, Judge White and Curran. The adverse effect in this case was this. They had a decision to make, a strategic decision, whether or not to call this witness, okay? They testified at evidentiary hearing. They were afraid that he was going to change his testimony based upon his new arrest. The problem here, the adverse effect on their representation, was the fact their decision-making process was not free and clear. It was constrained with the knowledge that they knew another attorney or had the expectation another attorney from their office was going to represent Sergio Aguilar. By the time they had to make this decision in this case, they knew for at least 12 days he was sitting in custody. Based upon their testimony, they had every expectation that another attorney from their office would be representing them. Because they had had this, they had this consideration, this impermissible consideration, which Edible speaks about, which Castro speaks about, it's not probabilities, but possibilities. They were not free and clear to use their judgment. They had an outside extraneous constraint.
I'm sorry to interrupt. So it's your position, and I said Kyler, I meant Mickens v. Taylor on remand.
Okay.
Apologize for that. But it seems to me what you're arguing are very fact-based questions. Let's assume for the sake of argument the trial counsel here had no knowledge whatsoever that anyone in the office represented Aguilar. We'll just assume that. Could we assume adverse effect anyway?
Well, I think what this court would do.
That's what I'm saying. That sounds very factual to
me. It is factual, but I think you make your legal conclusions, I guess, based upon what was presented at the evidentiary hearing.
But wouldn't that be for a trial judge to do? The Fourth Circuit case in Taylor gives a three-pronged fact question for the trial judge to sort out. And that's what I'm trying to figure out, because Kyler seems a little more as a matter of law, and I'm trying to figure out where the...
I think it's almost the same analysis when you do a Strickland analysis, you know, whether it was ineffective assistance of counsel. I think you look at the record, you look at the facts which were found, you know, see what the record supports those facts, then this court sees whether the conclusions of law were sufficient. Whereas Strickland, when you do a prejudice analysis and see, you know, that's the legal analysis which is the court would do, it's the same here, because there is no prejudice analysis, you're going to find an adverse effect. So the same analysis that you do, you know, comparatively speaking to a prejudice, you would do the same as for an adverse effect.
How much effect?
You don't get how much effect, it's whether there was any effect.
Any effect.
Any effect, that's it's a minimal standard. And the fact that there's this possibility that this could have been there, and that's what Curran speaks to, that's what Castro speaks to, and that's exactly what happened in this case.
Well, let me ask you this about the adverse effect. The other guy, Aguilar, gets arrested for attempted murder, right?
A gang-related attempted murder, correct.
Right. And he's the only guy that can put in the foundation for the gang book, as I understand it. Is that right?
That's correct.
So when they put him on the stand, he's going to take the Fifth Amendment, right, and not testify, and you're not going to get the book in anyway, or any evidence from him, are you?
Well, we don't know whether he's going to take the Fifth Amendment, and that's where another issue of the conflict comes, because there are going to be arguments about the scope of the Fifth and whether or not it applies. And who is counsel going to be arguing against? What's their expectation? They're going to argue against another attorney in their office with like 15 attorneys who they're going to have a relationship with. And that's what Peter speaks about, the issue of loyalty. And the whole purpose of imputed disqualification is that it assumes that they have relationships with these people. And that's the problem here. These thoughts, hey, I'm going to have to make legal arguments. I'm going to have to argue against another colleague in my office. They should not have been there. This is why there was a conflict. This is exactly why we have conflict laws, to avoid situations like this.
Didn't Mr. Cano's original trial counsel testify in the evidentiary hearing that she chose as a matter of strategy or tactics not to call Mr. Aguilar because he was a wild card and she didn't know what he was going to do? And so she thought, I shouldn't call him anyway.
Right, but
he's not going to be that helpful. And I don't know what he's going to say.
Yeah, and she says she's a walk-up because of his new arrest. That's why. Okay, and the fact that, well, she may have made a strategic reason call, the fact that there was an alternative defense tactic they could have used, and that tactic was exactly in conflict, you know, of what they wanted to do, because there was a divided loyalties here. You know, you don't know that she said that may have been attacked, but we don't know whether there was any other considerations. The problem was, and this is exactly what Edible speaks to, is the impermissible considerations. Like Cashel speaks about, the possibilities could have affected her judgment. Yet there could be an argument that that's the reason why she didn't, but there's an alternative argument. And that alternative argument isn't the reason why, isn't direct conflict of what, you know, of what reason why there was a conflict, if the court's following me here.
So I'm following you, and I think that's what Judge Furman was asking about, is who makes that decision? Us? Do we make that decision on the record that we have before us now? Or do we make that, or do we remand to the trial court to make that decision about whether or not Kano's original trial attorney was adversely affected in making those kinds of strategic decisions because Aguilar was represented by another public defender within the same office?
Okay, well, that's an interesting issue, but I think a remand is unnecessary, because I think based upon what was set forth in the hearing, and based upon the standard of, you know, what constitutes an adverse effect, I think we have already established an adverse effect. I don't think there needs to be any more findings or any more conclusions. You're asking the court to make a conclusion of law, and this court can make a de novo conclusion of law. And I'm asking this court to do so based upon the record that they were aware, you know, had every expectation that another attorney from our office was going to be representing Mr. Aguilar.
Sorry, I should have probably reminded you earlier, but you have about a minute and a half left.
I understand. Any questions, Your Honor?
Yes.
Okay, I'll reserve the rest of my time.
Thank you.
May it please the court, I'm Christine Brady, registration number 24779, representing the people. I'd like to start out talking about the standards, since the court had some questions about that, and to just say right off the bat that no, we do not need a remand. That's not necessary, and that's because we've already had an evidentiary hearing, and that was the 35C hearing. The standard is not...
Wasn't the court in that 35C evidentiary seeing its decision on the Strickland standards rather than the Kyler-Sullivan standards?
Well, the court did...
And does that make a difference after evidence has been already been received already?
I think what the court did was okay. The court did base it on the Strickland standard, but the Strickland standard does apply, the first prong. The first prong of Strickland, was there deficient performance? That does apply, and it applies under the Mickens standard for actual conflict. If there was an actual conflict, that means that defense counsel made a decision that negatively impacted the defense based on the fact that they were representing this other client, Aguilar.
Brady, would you concede deficient performance?
I do not concede that, no, Your Honor.
Because yeah, I mean, we have multiple concurrent representation.
Well, in this case, we have to look, because we're under the Mickens standard, we're not concerned about potential conflicts, and I think that's where some of the confusion might come in. The fact that there's multiple representation, if that's what we're looking at here, it assumes a potential conflict. And that's the Castro standard that the defendant had cited in his briefs. We were concerned with potential conflicts before Mickens. After Mickens, we don't really care about potential conflicts.
And Castro was way before Mickens, right?
It was a Colorado Supreme Court case. It was in 1983. Right. Mickens came out in 2002. And so getting back to my point about the trial court was not incorrect to apply the first prong of Strickland. Where the trial court went wrong is it applied the prejudice prong of Strickland, which does not apply now that we have the Mickens standard. The prejudice that we're talking about under Mickens has nothing to do with an actual different outcome of the verdict. We don't care about that. We assume that the verdict is unreliable. If defense counsel negatively impacted the defense theory, and in this case, of course, as she testified, there was nothing about the defense theory that was harmed here. She did not decline to call Aguilar because he was a client and she might have to cross-examine him. That was never the issue. The issue was he was a wild card. What was he going to say?
Why was he a wild card?
Okay, well, two reasons. First of all, his girlfriend, Madrigal, Ms. Madrigal testified, and she had changed her story. She initially said the defendant was not at the party. Then later she said he was at the party. And when she testified at trial, she said, yes, he was at the party.
That was after she tried to cut a deal, right?
That's after she tried to cut a deal.
On behalf of her boyfriend.
On behalf of Aguilar, correct. So at the 35C hearing, defense counsel testified that that is why I didn't call him. I thought that since he had changed all kinds of details about his story anyway, his original statement was defendant wasn't even at the party. We know that wasn't true, but that's what he said. Later on, he wasn't sure if defendant was at the party. Well, we didn't know if he was going to get on the stand, and so that he was not an alternate suspect, say, oh, yes, defendant was at the party, and he was the stabber. I saw him stab, or I saw him in the kitchen with the bloody knife, like the other five witnesses testified to. So this is what she was concerned about.
Let me ask you this. The very first thing that you said was you agreed that a remand would not be necessary if we were to find that the court erred. Does that mean, will you...
If the court erred in applying Strickland?
Right.
Correct. And what I said there was the court was correct to apply the first prong, superfluous to apply the prejudice prong.
Okay. Suppose we believe that we end up concluding that the court erred. Is there a scenario where a remand is necessary, or do you continue to believe that a remand would not be necessary and it would simply be reversed for a new trial?
Well, certainly we don't want reversal for a new trial.
I understand.
If the trial court incorrectly applied the standard, I think you can see if, based on the facts, usually when you have a remand, you need more facts. And the trial court here found, under the facts, that there was no adverse effect on the representation. The trial court.
Now, did the judge make? I'm sorry to interrupt.
Sure.
Did the judge make that particular finding? Because the judge was proceeding under Strickland. I think that's real clear.
Right. And again, it's okay to proceed under Strickland under that first prong. The trial court found there was no deficient performance because there was, well, hang on. Get the exact words here. Yeah, the trial court said that the defense counsel's representation was not adversely affected because all of the trial preparation was done before the trial, which means that all the trial preparation was already done. She had already made all of her decisions before Aguilar was taken into custody. And I think it helps also that it's true that there were two attorneys on this case, but the first chair, the main attorney, the female attorney, she actually testified that, sure, she did know Aguilar was in custody, but you know, she made it a point not to have any information about, you know, did someone enter appearance?
Notwithstanding the common practice of the office.
Correct.
And the second chair attorney did seem to know.
At some point, the second chair knew because he said he knew about the charges. He saw that information in the file.
That was before the trials actually started. Is that not correct?
That was. The timing here is very murky. We know that the drive-by shooting occurred within a week before trial. And we know that the day before trial started, there was a general appearance by the public defender, which...
And the file was then at least in existence.
It was in existence.
I thought the second chair attorney knew the existence of that file, had actually seen it or something like that. Is that not correct?
Yeah, he testified that at some point that stuff was turned over to him and it was actually put into the defendant's
Now, how is that not multiple concurrent representation on its face? Talking about the adverse effect question. I'm talking about just multiple concurrent.
We're just talking about the conflict.
Yes.
I guess my answer to that is perhaps it's an imputed conflict, which we...
But Rodriguez was around, right? I mean,
yes.
the imputation doctrine was alive and well.
It was alive and well, and it would have been very important if the issue had been raised during trial or before Mickens v. Taylor came out. But I guess what I'm saying is now after Mickens, we are not really concerned for Sixth Amendment purposes, the defendant's right to counsel. We're not concerned about imputed disqualification.
Okay, but we are concerned with multiple concurrent representation. A question of adverse effect, I'm not to yet, but
in that case, the multiple without imputed, yes, we would care if the same attorneys who were representing defendant here were also representing Aguilar. That would be multiple. But we no longer have the imputed rule for...
Back then, though, the practice was quite different.
Sure, and back then...
I mean, I assume it's different, I don't know, but...
Well, back then, there was... Well, we don't have people be Sherry interpreting 1.1 in 2008. This trial was in 1996. Back then, we might have raised an eyebrow and asked, you know, aren't you violating an ethical rule, and in violation of that ethical rule, doesn't that rise to the level of Sixth Amendment? Because back then we did apply it that way. But Mickens applies to this case because this case is on review after Mickens. And the ethics board probably cares about what happened with the imputed, but that is not a Sixth Amendment violation.
Let me go back to my question because I'm still a little bit confused about what your position is on this.
Okay.
If we conclude that a reversal is required because the wrong standard was applied,
okay. Do
we remand? Your colleague, Mr. Lansky, says it would be unnecessary to remand. What's your position on that?
My question would be, what is the reason for the reversal? Is it simply because you believe the trial court did not understand the Mickens standard?
Well, I haven't reached that yet, either okay. Hypothetically or realistically. But he made the point of saying that remand would not be necessary. And I'm trying to see if you agree with him that if there were a reversal, that remand would not be necessary.
I think if the reason for the reversal is you think the trial court applied the wrong standard, then we still need the trial court to look at the facts and rule under the correct standard. So yes, in that case, it would need to be remanded. I'm not sure we would need additional facts. We would just need a ruling under the correct Mickens standard. Are there any other questions? Then the people would respectfully request that you affirm the defendant's conviction. Thank you.
I just want to make a few responses. The decision to call Sergio Aguilar was not made before trial. The attorney testified at the evidentiary hearing that it was still an open question during the trial.
Were you at that hearing? You tried that hearing?
Yes. And she clearly stated on the record that, you know, I've made a decision what we were going to do. We were seeing how the trial was going. And because of that, because of knowledge of the expectation another attorney from their office would be representing them, that's the adverse effect. And I guess to respond to Judge Roman's last question about the remand, I mean, again, the standard is a de novo review. I understand, you know, for appellate purposes, the court needs to have a ruling from the court, and then, you know, you'd see whether that was the right, you know, ruling or not. But if it's a de novo standard review and the court has all the information, he knows the court is aware that they were, you know, had the expectation or the awareness that another attorney from their office was representing this witness who could provide exculpatory and material information, which was central to their defense. I think it's already apparent that there was an adverse effect in representation. So I will rest on that, and I will ask the court to reverse the court's ruling and to reverse my client's conviction. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lansky. And thank you, Ms. Grady, for your arguments. This matter will stand before the court, submitted to the court, and an opinion will issue in due course.